Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the most bloated government program contributing to the deficit that appears immune to Washington's hand-wringing over the fiscal cliff, and that is the military budget. The author of Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy, investigative journalist Andrew Coburn, joins us. He has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times defending defense cuts. When it comes to the U.S. military budget, the fiscal cliff isn't all that scary. Then we'll look into the role of Senator Feinstein's husband, Richard Blum, the head of the world's largest commercial real estate company, who has an exclusive contract with the U.S. Postal Service to list and sell its valuable and historic public property as the Congress deliberately bankrupts the post office in the name of free enterprise. UC Berkeley professor of geography Gray Breschen joins us to discuss the theft of our national heritage, which the press is ignoring while only reporting that the Postal Service is in default, but not why, and who is profiting from its deliberate destruction. Then finally, we'll examine the newly sworn-in Mexican president Peña Nieto and the makeup of his cabinet with George Grayson, the author of Mexican Messiah, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, and Criminal Entrepreneurs. We will discuss the possibility of immigration reform and a new approach to the failed war on drugs that has claimed over 50,000 Mexican lives in the last 6 years. Joining us now is Andrew Coburn, an investigative journalist and author of several books on defense and international affairs. He's also written about the Middle East for The New Yorker and co-produced the 1991 PBS documentary on Iraq, The War We Left Behind. His latest book is Rumsfeld, The Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. And he has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times defending defense cuts. When it comes to the U.S. military budget, the fiscal cliff isn't all that scary. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Coburn.
Good to be with you.
And it is a pretty extraordinary to learn, and as I think most people did via the Petraeus scandal, the extent to which not only are there military groupies chasing these beribboned generals around like groupies chasing rock stars, but they have a fairly lavish lifestyle with private jets, police motorcade, motorcycle escorts, cooks, and valets. Do you think that the constant refrain in the press and amongst our politicians about paying homage to our fighting men is being somewhat revised here, or are they still immune from the kind of criticism that they clearly deserve?
I think they've taken a bit of a dent. I mean, it's kind of absurd to call them fighting men because they don't actually do much fighting. But they live like gods. They have, you know, very commodious houses. They have very extensive and attentive staffs. And I think most important of all, no one ever contradicts them. So, which might account for some of the problems we've been having.
Well, apparently that was the problem that Petraeus was having at the CIA. Their culture is such where junior officers are encouraged to weigh in with their criticisms. And apparently Petraeus simply couldn't handle the idea that these young insubordinate upstarts were talking back to him.
Right. If you've been a, you know, if he's... I don't think anyone's probably done that since he got his first star as a general. I mean, generals, and particularly when you get to the 3- and 4-star level, generals are treated like, as I said, like gods. But of course, you know, the cooks and valets are are the least of our problems. But I think it, you know, indicates the mindset. It's a militaristic mindset. It also reminds me of the parody of a Latin American general. I mean, I don't want to single them out, or, you know, weighed down with gold epaulettes, gold stars and all that. That's what we're getting to, and I think it's very dangerous and decadent, really.
Well, apparently there are more shoes to drop in the Petraeus affair. That's my understanding. I don't know quite what to make of that, but already... Do you have any?
Well, I don't know. I think first of all, you have to start with the presumption that is it really so likely that merely because a low-level FBI agent has discovered that the director of Central Intelligence is having has had an extramarital affair that they're going to turf out the head of the CIA for that? You know, it's inherently unlikely. So if even if that was the excuse, there had to be, and I don't you know, since I can't say I've sort of checked it, I don't want to sort of just spout off rumors on the air, but they, you know, one in Washington, you do hear a lot of suggestions that they had much more serious issues with Petraeus and gave him the option of just resigning over this, which, you know, people could, you know, all his supporters came out in Washington and said, oh, it's so terrible, we're losing the great hero Petraeus. And, you know, practically some of the sort of news correspondents who've been getting his leaks for years were practically in tears when they announced the news. But that, you know, so that was fairly benign, but I'm convinced that there was, you know, a much more serious reason for letting him go, like that.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Coburn, who's an investigative journalist and author of several books on defense and international affairs. His latest book is Rumsfeld, The Rise and Fall, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. And he has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times, Defending Defense Cuts. When it comes to the U.S. military budget, the fiscal cliff isn't all that scary. Now, do you think, Andrew Coburn, that the only way the defense budget will be cut is via the sequester? In other words, it's never been cut in spite of, going back to 1960, the warning by outgoing President Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex. It's inexorably grown and has become a kind of form of right-wing welfare in this country that's untouchable.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, not many people realize that we're way above the Cold War average. You know, if you measure it, you know, accounting for inflation. You know, for all those years, we've had this enormous budget, which I always thought was, you know, ridiculously inflated anyway. But they were, at least, the excuse was they were confronting a superpower, you know, the Soviet Union, which had a very extensive, albeit overrated, military of its own. Now, you know, there's nothing like that. I mean, we outspend, you know, we spend as much as the rest of the world put together, and yet the budget is higher, really, in real terms, than it was during the Cold War, which is completely absurd, obviously. And, you know, amazingly, if this sequester thing goes through, it will, for the first time, suffer a serious cut. I mean, not that serious. If sequester is kind of a big mouthful of a word, but, you know, if these mandatory cuts are fully implemented, we'll go back to the level we were in 2007.
Right.
It seemed pretty vast then, but it shows how much bigger it is now. But, you know, as I said in the article, you know, to listen to the defense chiefs and the Secretary of Defense and all the think tanks and the whole enormous tribe that lives off this, I mean, you know, we'll be doomed. And, you know, I don't know, the North Koreans and Al-Qaeda will be stomping all over us if this thing goes through.
Well, one of the things you point out in the article is, which is shocking, is that the Lightning II, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, currently consumes no less than 38% of the entire defense procurement budget. Now, the sequester is a blunt instrument, so presumably they're going to cut across the board. But surely that one, I mean, I've spoken to Pierre Spray, the designer of the the A-10 attack fighter and the F-16, the very successful U.S. aircraft. And He's been railing against the F-22 Raptor for some time, and this turkey, this F-35. And basically, his argument is that this stealth technology is a complete myth. It's a hoax that the defense industries came up with this new branding that they're able to soak the taxpayer for. And it turns out to, because it's so cumbersome, it turns these planes into flying turkeys.
Well, that's right. And it doesn't, I mean, you know, we should make it very clear that it doesn't make the planes invisible to radar. It makes them, it diminishes their radar signature at certain profiles. I mean, it depends which way the plane is facing. And, you know, as I point out, certain wavelengths of, you know, the stealth features embodied in the aircraft are designed against particular wavelength radars, long wavelength radars, which the Russians have been making for a very long time. Aren't bothered by this. So, as I point out, the Russians make an extremely efficient and very affordable long wavelength radar at the moment, which they're marketing around. I mean, it's portable. You can drive it around the roads. And it's a very affordable at $10 million. So against the, I don't know what we want to price the F-35 per copy at now, I think $400 million is quite a is a reasonable estimate, probably an underestimate. Against that, and a lot of that $400 million is this stealth, you know, supposedly magic stealth technology. If you nip around the corner to the Russian Arms Export Agency and slap down $10 million, you can have a radar that detects it.
And the overall, as you point out in your article in the Los Angeles Times, Andrew Coben, in defense of defense cuts, when it comes to the U.S. military, the fiscal cliff isn't all that scary. The oversight put the overall lifetime, the government oversight project puts the overall lifetime cost of the F-35 at $1.5 trillion, more than the annual gross domestic product of Spain.
isn't that amazing? This is one pretty, you know, not very bad performing fighter plane. I mean, $1.5 trillion, that's amazing.
Right, and its predecessor, the F-22, the pilots are blacking out because of the oxygen. I mean, they've had oxygen in airplanes since the 1930s, and somehow the state-of-the-art aircraft can't feed oxygen without making their pilots unconscious. And
right, because the oxygen into the intake for the pilot's oxygen supply, actually, it looks like it's getting polluted with some of the toxins from the stealth coatings on the engine intake. So it's stealth strikes again, really.
And the Navy is also, this is, we're talking about the Air Force's snout in the government trough here, but the Navy's got this 3,000-ton littoral combat ship at $500 million a copy. It apparently has a tendency to veer off course at high speeds and develop cracks and rust. That's in your article.
Almost immediately, yeah. It's because they tried to be clever and reduce the weight by mixing, you know, building the hull is on one part on the top it's aluminum and then it's steel. But it turns out it's very, very hard to bond aluminum and steel. And certainly as far as the littoral combat ship is concerned. So they've had a huge problem with cracks and also, consequent to the cracks, rust. And then they... As you said, at high speeds, the official euphemism is directional instability. It means that if it gets in a well-designed ship, if you're proceeding along and a wave knocks it, you know, half a degree to one side or the other, it'll has a tendency to go back, you know, keep going straight. With this ship, it keeps swinging, so the helmsman has to sort of keep jerking the tiller to keep it going in a roughly straight line.
And further in terms of the fiscal follies here, you've got the Army wanting to spend $34 billion on the ground fighting vehicle, which is a troop carrier projected to weigh up to 84 tons, which is more than the M1 Abrams tank. And then you've also got another project which is actually being deployed, Gorgon Stare, which is a drone-mounted video system supposedly able to surveil a whole town day and night, and it's failed its tests so dramatically that testers urge it not to be fielded, but the Air Force shipped it to Afghanistan anyway. What's the latest on how it's doing in Afghanistan?
Well, every time I ask, you know, when you ask the Air Force, as I've done repeatedly, say, well, give me some details on how it's performing, and the people in the Air Force team that did the tests, I mean, they isolated a whole number of problems or identified a whole number of problems. So I periodically write to the Air Force saying, you know, how have you overcome the following problems? And if so, how? Well, maybe they can't tell me how, but it'd be nice to know that they have overcome the problems. The Air Force refuses to reply, simply saying, oh, it's doing wonderfully. And, you know, the reports from the troops in the field are ecstatic about this tremendous aid in fighting the Afghan war. Well, I know a lot of people who are or have been on the ground in Afghanistan, U.S. soldiers and Marines, and I keep asking them. I said, have you found Gorgon Stare useful? And they say, what's that? We never heard of it. So it's been deployed, but it's been kept, it's not being much used to anyone as far as I can tell, because they haven't told the troops about it. Maybe because, it's, as I suspect, it's not really working very well.
So, Andrew Coburn, what's your understanding of whether this president, now that he's got something of a mandate, even though the Republicans are denying him any kind of credit for winning a second term and for picking up, and the Democrats are picking up extra seats in the Senate, he's did in his debate with Romney more or less humiliate Romney when he talked about how Romney complained about how our defenses were being eviscerated by Obama. And of course, Obama pointed out, made the joke about, you know, in response to the notion that we have the smallest Navy since 1916, he rather patronizingly explained about submarines and aircraft carriers to Romney. But beyond that, is there any indication that Obama gets it, that since the Republicans essentially being hoisted on their own petard, and it looks like the Democrats may just let this fiscal cliff hyperbole happen, and Obama can basically blame it on them, can't he?
Well, he can, yes. I mean, it's, you know, who knows, but, I mean, you know, there's always a suspicion that he'll follow his usual, his customary instincts and sort of give away a bit of the store. Like, you know, there's a terrible possibility that he'll say, okay, well, we've got a deal on tax increases for the wealthy, and in return, yes, we're going to chop Medicare, raise the Medicare age when you can get Medicare, which will be, in effect, a, you know, privatization of part of Medicare. Or, you know, do something to Social Security. But let's hope he doesn't. Maybe he won't. He doesn't have to, of course. And, you know, he may get it about defense. I mean, the problem is that if they just chop, if the sequester, the way it's officially, you know, it's framed, just chopping, you know, X percent off across the board, I mean, that will cause a lot of problems. I mean, better than not cutting it at all, but I mean, you really need to sort of cut out sort of turkeys like the F-35 or the littoral combat ship and, you know, in fact, cut them out anyway, whether you're cutting the budget or not. Will Obama stand up to the defense lobby like no president has done since Eisenhower, which he did like a week before he was leaving office? It doesn't really count.
Right. Well, of course,
I don't know. Would it be in character? I mean, Obama loves... He, as we all know, he loves drones. He loves, you know, superior elite commando, special force, SEAL Team 6 type things. And he loves all that sort of covert world. Perhaps in the mistaken belief that it's cheap, which it certainly isn't. And he may use the authority he's got, both from his, you know, the election, from the mandate, you know, that mandate, and from, you know, this hysteria over the impending, you know, fiscal crisis, which, you know, is entirely artificial, because we don't need to have all these cuts, really.
Well, but also, it's also not just artificial. It's distracting us from the debate we should be having, which is about austerity, which is a disaster.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really an excuse. I mean, it's, you know, as I'm sure you know, I mean, it's really a well, clever marketing campaign to get, you know, to ram, you know, Greek or at least Spanish style austerity down our throats, which, you know, one can hope that Obama will fight that, but I'm not that hopeful.
Well, Andrew Coburn, I thank you for your piece in the LA Times and for joining us here today.
Well, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Coburn, who's an investigative journalist and author of several books on defense and international affairs. He's also written about the Middle East for The New Yorker and co-produced the 1991 PBS documentary on Iraq, The War We Left Behind. His latest book is Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. And he has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times, Defending Defense Cuts. When it comes to the U.S. military budget, the fiscal cliff isn't that scary. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how Senator Feinstein's husband is profiting from the deliberate destruction of the United States Postal Service.
How low were are you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? Impatient after impatient, this means war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Gray Breschen, who's an historical geographer and author. He's currently a visiting scholar at the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and the founder and project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project. His books include Farewell Promised Land, Waking from the California Dream, and Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Gray Breschen.
Thank you, Ian.
And today there are demonstrations in Berkeley to save the venerable Berkeley's post office built in 1914, its main post office that has priceless New Deal artworks in it. And I take it that the demonstrators are focusing a lot of their ire on the husband of California Senator Dianne Feinstein. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. He actually is the chairman and large stockholder in a company called CBRE, the world's largest commercial real estate company, which last summer got an exclusive contract with the U.S. Postal Service to sell the public's property, and also apparently to advise the Postal Service on which properties it should sell, which means that what was the first line of post offices that are going up and are in some of the most expensive downtown real estate in the country. And many of them have really irreplaceable buildings and also public art in them.
So he is also a regent of the University of California, is he not, Richard Blum?
He's not just a regent, he's the alpha regent. He basically is the most dominant of all the regents. So a great deal of what goes on in the university now is out of Richard Blum's office, one of which, by the way, is now on the UC Berkeley campus. He actually, it's the first time I know of in which a regent has actually built an office building on the Berkeley campus.
Well, he
named it after himself, I should say.
He must be feeling a little bit of a heat from the protesters. The signs and the flyer distributed says, Richard Blum, philanthropist, opportunist, thief of our national heritage. Is this message getting to him?
I don't think it's getting to him because he's on a business trip in Asia right now, though I'm sure that his staff is informing him of this, as would be Senator Feinstein's staff as well, too. Because they're very scrupulous about managing their reputations, as is the San Francisco Chronicle, which has managed it for them for many years and really covered for them. So they're not used to unflattering portrayals, let's say.
So Gray Breschen, again, historical geographer and author, currently visiting scholar at the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and founder and project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project. And you're involved in these demonstrations. You've been involved for some time in trying to save the Postal Service from essentially from the United States Congress. I mean, in 2006, the Congress passed the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, which transfers $5.5 billion each year from the Postal Service to the U.S. Treasury. Recently, the U.S. Postal Service defaulted on their payments, but they've paid so far. The Treasury is holding $45.3 billion in the Postal Service Retirement Health Fund. And this was a unique imposition by the Congress to make the Postal Service pay, I think, 75 years worth of retirement benefits forward. Nobody else has been required to do this. It looks as though at the time the Republican Congress was finding a way to essentially destroy the post office. And, of course, President Bush signed on to this as well. So give us some background on why the post office is stuck with this onerous and draconian financial regime that's bankrupting it.
Well, no one's really quite sure how that legislation got through. It's a little mysterious, and I believe it was also bipartisan, although it would, of course, be led by the Republicans. There are many neoliberal Republican libertarians in particular who believe that there shouldn't be any public domain, any public service whatsoever, but the Postal Service is relatively popular as a federal agency because it provides universal and honest and reasonably priced service. And so they had to do an end run. So in 2006, as you said, they fed the Postal Service this cyanide pill, requiring it to essentially bankrupt itself by prefunding these pensions. It was an ingenious act. It seems to have just flown below everybody's radar. And so now, of course, the news that it's totally insolvent, that gets into the news. But what doesn't get into the news is that this is a splendid way to essentially privatize the public's property, the huge real estate portfolio, which the taxpayers have paid for over actually several centuries, is now being liquidated by the U.S. Postal Service, by the Postmaster General, Mr. Donahue. And if you look at the Board of Governors of the Postal Service right now, mostly appointed by Bush II, some appointed by Obama, they are, to a man and a woman, people committed to the privatization of our postal system. They're not committed to public service. What they are committed to is to privatizing the service, turning it over to public to private agencies, and at the same time, liquidating the real estate. So it's morphed from the U.S. Postal Service has morphed from a public service agency into a real estate agency using a broker, a private broker, Richard Blum's company, CBRE, to sell and market those buildings. Unfortunately, as I said, the highest value real estate is going for sale first, although everything will be available very soon as they drive it into the ground. And among those are post offices all through Southern California. I'm sure many of your listeners know this. Venice was just sold and privatized by Joel Silver, who now owns the old Venice post office. La Jolla is going up for sale. Fullerton, Santa Barbara, Beverly Hills. Really, there's a disproportionate representation in California because our real estate is so high. The only runner-up is the Gold Coast of Greenwich, the Greenwich Gold Coast in Connecticut. But it's really, you know, we're losing magnificent buildings and the public art that, as I said, my parents paid for. And these buildings and the art are unique in the United in the world. No other nation in the world has an inheritance like this. It's just disappearing. It's been stolen from us, actually, and the press has been absolutely negligent in covering what's going on. So that's why we wanted to have the protest today. It's the first time that Regent Blum and his wife, Senator Feinstein, have been identified as parties in this theft of the public domain.
And Dr. Gray Breschen, the United States Postal Service was established in Article 1 of the Constitution, and Benjamin Franklin was our first Postmaster General. So it's in the historical DNA of this country. I know that Senator Bernie Sanders, who I speak with fairly often, has been trying to save the Postal Service. He's also been trying to change the law to unshackle the Postal Service from the restrictions it has from doing banking and other issuing fishing licenses, etc., stuff that the Post Office used to do to make it more competitive. It seems that the Kool-Aid that the press is drinking is that the Postal Service is going out of business because of competition from UPS and FedEx. But what they're not talking about is how the Congress is deliberately trying to bankrupt it, one, and two, how the Congress has restrained the Postal Service from delivering services at a community level that they used to deliver.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And the press has been incredibly lazy on this whole issue. It doesn't want to really go into what's actually happening. It will sometimes mention the 2006 requirement. What it usually mentions is the Internet made us do it. That's the official line. Because mail volume is, of course, admittedly dropping, but it still provides, the Postal Service provides a vital service that is very much needed and mandated in the Congress, and it hasn't been really covering this. Bernie Sanders, of course, is concerned about the Postal Service, not only because of the principle that's involved, the public principle, but he comes from a largely rural state. And if the Postmaster General is successful, we won't have a Postal Service in about 5 to 10 years. And then all the rural towns through the country will essentially not have Postal Service. And that was why Ben Franklin and others since him, other postmasters since him, required the U.S. Postal Service to provide universal service so that anybody living out in the wilds of Wyoming or Vermont or whatever get the same kind of service that we in the cities get. And that's, of course, expensive, even though the Postal Service is self-funded. With the privatization of the Postal Service, essentially all the small towns, the rural areas, will lose postal delivery because that's not profitable for UPS and FedEx.
But the demonstrations that took place today in San Francisco to save Berkeley's 1914 Maine post office and to demonstrate against Richard Blum, the wife of Senator Dianne Feinstein, whose office the demonstrators were in front of, holding up signs, calling her husband Richard Blum philanthropist, opportunist, thief of our national heritage. This is an added outrage that not only has the Congress is deliberately destroying the post office to allow for the privatization of it, but these real estate sharks are jumping in and grabbing all this prime property. That's what these demonstrations are about.
Oh, yes, exactly. It's exactly what Naomi Klein has talked about, disaster capitalism. You know, you provoke a crisis and then you profit from it. In this case, by privatizing the public's land. You could say they're stealing the public's land, like the robber barons did in the 19th century. This is just happening in the 21st century, and instead the lands being public lands, you know, out in the wilderness or on the outskirts of the city. This is prime property in the downtowns of every American city and town. And if those cities are thriving, like Santa Monica, for example, you know, that property is worth a tremendous amount of money. So the public's real estate portfolio is worth literally billions of dollars. And anybody who could get their hands on it would stand to make a very handsome profit from that. And I can't imagine that having a chairman of the board of a company like CBRE, who is married to the most powerful senator in Congress, could have hurt CBRE in getting that contract, that exclusive contract, to deal, to sell and advise the Postal Service on its properties.
And the tragedy here is that not only do these real estate sharks like the senator's, Feinstein's husband, get the inside track, get to choose who buys these properties, they also, from what I understand, a lot of these properties, because they're in prime locations, are destroyed. And all of this priceless New Deal art, the murals, etc., are gone forever. I mean, that's a part of what people are demonstrating about, aren't they? Trying to preserve American history?
Yes, that's true. The buildings are often not destroyed because they're so beautiful that people like to turn them into restaurants or bed and breakfast or even private homes, real estate offices, etc., but they're no longer public as they were intended to be. And so that's what we're concerned about. And then the art itself is left in a kind of legal limbo where nobody's quite sure who owns it or has responsibility for it. The Postal Service has, theoretically, it still owns that. But in the case of Venice, California, Joel Silver, the new owner of that building, effectively owns the beautiful Biberman mural on the history of Venice. It's theoretically still owned by the Postal Service. This is a tremendous loss because in so many towns across the United States, the only public art is the art that was painted in the post office. And that that art typically reflects the local people back to them, and especially in the work that they did. And that was very important, of course, during the Depression, because work was on everybody's mind. How do you get work? How do you get self-respect through work? And I would say that the same thing is absolutely true now. We're in a kind of minor depression, unless you're actually in it, and then it's every bit as great as the one of the 1930s. And so people need work. And it's to the Roosevelt administration's credit that they actually depicted people doing work in so many of our post offices. Perhaps that's one of the reasons that they actually want to get rid of them, because it reminds people that work is the source of one's livelihood and one's self-respect. And if you can just get rid of it, well, people don't think about it as much, perhaps. It's like lowering the flag on these beautiful buildings, which reminded you of your connection with the federal government. And they inspired pride in you. They were meant to, because they're so well built, so well embellished, that we're losing a vital connection to the government that is supposed to serve us all, not just a few people like Richard Blum and his wife, Dianne Feinstein.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Gray Breschen, how much of this is being driven by ideology with all of this dogma about free enterprise and big government being evil? We heard a lot of that, in this last campaign. What I find a little bit phony about that argument about free enterprise being virtuous and government being evil is that these people like Richard Blum, who are married to United States senators, clearly have some inside track in getting these deals and are able to literally steal the fruits of public labor and public property and make a killing. And that's not free enterprise. That's rigged enterprise.
Well, absolutely. And most of these people, as I said, are either neoliberals or, which I think Richard Blum is, the idea that everything should be run more like a business, everything as much as possible should be privatized and deregulated. Or you're libertarians, in which you don't believe in government at all, which you really sort of idealize as anarchy. So there's a real ideology behind this. But at the same time...
But it's so self-serving, though. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's not... The ideology is just window dressing for greed.
Well, of course. And I was just back in Washington last week talking to various people about this, and they said, you know, this business model doesn't make any sense to sell off buildings that they own and then lease space elsewhere in crummy buildings that will provide poor service. It doesn't make any financial sense. And I said, you know, it does if you are CBRE or if you're an ideologue who doesn't believe in government at all. It makes perfect sense. But for those of us who depend upon the post office and would like to have better service from it rather than the reduced service we have now, it doesn't make any sense. But once again, Ian, you know, the reason people aren't aware of this is because the press has fallen down so shamefully on doing this. Of course, there's very little investigative reporting anymore, so this hasn't entered into the press. So you have to rely on an invaluable website like SaveThePostOffice.com, the absolutely essential go-to website to find out what's really going on.
Well, Dr. Gray Breschen, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Gray Breschen, who's an historical geographer and author. He is currently a visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and founder and project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project. His books include Farewell Promised Land, Waking from the California Dream, and Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Mexico's new president.
Serbia, working for pennies, treated like a slave. The coca fields have to be ready. The spirit of my people is starving, broken and sweaty, dreaming about revolution, looking at my machete. But the workload is too heavy to rise up in arms, and if I ran away, I know they'd probably murder my moms.
Okay, listen, Juan Valdez, just get me my product before we chop off your hands for workers' misconduct. I got the power to shoot a cop up and not get charged, and it would be sad to see your family in front of a firing squad. So the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Grayson, a professor of comparative politics at the College of William and Mary. He's written more than 20 books, including The North American Free Trade Agreement, Regional Community and the New World Order, Oil and Mexican Foreign Policy, Mexican Messiah, Andres Manuel López Obrador, and his latest book, The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs. He's also an associate scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Grayson.
Very nice to be with you.
And there's a brand new president in Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, 46 years old, known better for his good looks than his deep thinking. But it looks like he's entering office in the last, he's just entered office with fairly favorable economic and political conditions. That's assuming, of course, that the U.S. Congress gets its acts together. If they do make a deal, most economists think that the U.S. economy could pick up by at least 3%. And since trade with the U.S., Mexico's trade with the U.S. accounts for 82% of its exports, that should be good for Mexico, right?
Absolutely. But the cabinet he has appointed has a number of people who are eager to promote foreign trade, but also diversify export markets, because Mexico is 80% dependent on the U.S. And every time a new chief executive comes into office, he says we've got to have a more varied portfolio of international consumers.
So, obviously, they don't like being dependent upon the United States, but they are benefiting from high commodity prices. And my understanding is that the gap between Chinese and Mexican wages has narrowed considerably. So, how does that stand?
That's correct. And so, the Mexicans are hoping to take advantage of opportunities in the international market.
So give us a sense then of the cabinet that Peña Nieto has put together. I mean, there's been a lot of skepticism about him because he is representing the PRI party, which is a notoriously corrupt and authoritarian institution. Its very name, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, is a strange kind of oxymoron. And they ruled Mexico almost as long as the Communist Party of the Soviet Union ruled the Soviet Union, and perhaps there were some analogies there, but we're talking about supposedly a new modern pre-party. So how much is he shedding the baggage of the old pre?
The pre has no discernible ideology, and so its orientation is whatever the incumbent president says it is. And I think you're right that Peña Nieto would never be confused with a Rhodes Scholar. But he has one advantage, and that is he knows what he doesn't know, and he's got the self-assurance to complement these gaps in his preparation by bringing in highly competent people. And so that's something that augurs well for Mexico. And the cabinet really is outstanding. And one example is he's got a crafty old former governor from Mexico State who's going to be the education secretary. And he's going to take on the education union, which has colonized public schools in Mexico. Its leader, Elbester Gordillo, was once called a Jimmy Hoffa in a skirt, and she is tough as nails, and this is going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight to try to impose national standards and greater transparency in the teaching profession, because as things now stand, you buy your teacher's job, or you buy your job to be in a posh Mexico City suburb. and it's highly politicized.
Well, again, I'm speaking with George Grayson, Professor of Comparative Politics at the College of William & Mary. He's written more than 20 books, largely about Mexico, oil and Mexican foreign policy, and Mexican messiah Andres Manuel López Obrador. His latest is The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers and Criminal Entrepreneurs. He's also Associate Research Scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. And we're talking about the ascension of the new president of Mexico a few days ago, Peña Nieto, and the kind of political and economic landscape he's facing. Now, he's going to benefit, I guess, from the Mexican Congress's in its final days under former President Felipe Calderón. Apparently, they restricted labor rights, well, depending on how you interpret it. It could be called labor reform, but the long and the short of it is it's made it easier for companies to hire and fire workers in Mexico. Fill us in on that, if you will.
That's right. Mexico's labor law went back to 1951, and there just was no opportunity to accomplish mobility within the workforce. And regrettably, the unions are as corrupt as any unions in the world. And my dad was a Teamster, and I'm not anti-union. But there was just immobility with respect to being able to move employees from one job to another, change their shifts, promote them in a basis on merit as opposed to just simply the number of years they had been at work. However, the union bosses got something out of this, and that is there are not open elections for union leaders. These take place with raised hands, and so if you're a petroleum worker or a teacher or a railroad worker, your boss of the union knows exactly for whom you voted, and there will be retribution if you don't vote according to his desires.
So how is this going to translate then in terms of the Mexican economy? I mean, if you say there's more job mobility, does that mean in any way that people's job security or their pensions, et cetera, have been affected?
No, that their pensions are safe, but the ability to fire someone who is just outrageously incompetent is quite limited. And it still is limited, but employers will have a bit more discretion. But if they want to move a part of their workforce from one plant to another, they really have to arm wrestle the union to get such approval. They'll have more flexibility, and they'll also have more flexibility in hiring and promotions. So the business community is by and large satisfied with the deal and the fact that the average union members don't get to elect democratically their leaders is just their problem.
So again, George Grayson, expert on Mexico, writes for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal and the author of The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers and Criminal Entrepreneurs. Let's turn to that subject that you've written about recently, George, and that is, of course, this failed war on drugs. We here in California have just had an incident off the Channel Islands off Santa Barbara where a Coast Guard officer was killed by a couple of Mexican drug smugglers, or assumed to be drug smugglers, in an open sort of skiff that they rammed the Coast Guard, which is a pretty brazen act, which makes you realize the sort of thorough brutality of this war. Now, it has claimed the life of one American Coast Guard officer. Of course, it's claimed the life of how many thousands of Mexicans?
I think the count as of this weekend was 47,500. But that doesn't include those who are missing or those who have been displaced.
And how many? What's the percentage of those people that have been killed that are innocent victims as opposed to inter-gang criminal murders?
It won't surprise you to say that the government doesn't release those kinds of figures. The government talks in terms of 95% being in the underworld or being police officers or military cadres or judges, but we simply don't know, and human rights organizations place the percentage much higher.
Percentage of what? The innocence?
Percentage of those who have died in the drug war who are non-combatants.
I see.
Who suffer what the Pentagon euphemistically calls collateral damage.
So what, in terms of this new cabinet then that the new president of Mexico has, what can you learn, what can you tell us about their attitude to the war on drugs? My understanding is that the fact that the United States, in the most recent election here in the United States, the states of Colorado and Washington moved to legalize marijuana for recreational use, that's given a little bit of wind in the sails of those in South and Central and South America who've been arguing for the longest time that the U.S. war on drugs has failed and that they have to come up with a new plan.
Peña Nieto's first, second, and third priorities are reducing the amount of bloodshed. And to that end, he wants to form a 40,000-member gendarmerie that would be headed by civilians but would be made up largely of Army and Navy personnel. And one of the possible barriers to that is that the new Secretary of Navy is young, bright, modern, and he's eager to cooperate with the United States. In contrast, Peña Nieto has named the most senior general in the Army to become the new Secretary of Defense, and he's a traditionalist who really blanches at the idea of close cooperation with Uncle Sam. So that may impede the formation of this gendarmerie and also exacerbate inter-service rivalries.
Well, but closer cooperation with the United States, with, you mentioned in terms of this young admiral in charge of the Navy, the Mexican Navy, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have a more enlightened approach. I mean, my understanding is that the U.S. is stuck on this militarized war on drugs, and that they won't—they're very inflexible in terms of coming up with new ways to reduce demand here in the United States, because we're really the problem. We're the market. That's where the drugs end up. That's where the money is made. That's where the money is then shipped into Mexico, along with a bunch of high-powered weapons.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think the United States is giving Peña Nieto complete freedom of action as he configures his version of the war on drugs. But I think it's going to be with smaller forces that are mobile and that make use of state-of-the-art technology, that employ eavesdroppers and informants. But there has to be substantial emphasis on the money flows, because that obviously is the propeller that drives the drug aircraft. And if you can get a handle on the money flows and reduce those even marginally, you can hurt the dons, the mafiosi, where it really does the most damage, and that's in their bank accounts.
So the other issue, of course, that's both important here north of the border in the United States and south of the border is the issue of immigration. And there is a possibility, I think the Republican Party haven't learned a lot from this last election, except that they've alienated Latinos, the growing demographic here in the United States, and then a lot of the more sensible voices in the Republican Party are saying that we've got to do something about that, or the Republicans have to do something about that. So there's an indication that there may be a deal in the works in terms of immigration reform here in the United States. What's your sense of that?
Well, I have a little bit different view, and that is, I think Mexico is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, that if Singapore could lease Mexico for 20 years, we would be talking about the Colossus of the South and would be buying pogo sticks to jump the wall. And the problem is, Not that I'm at all hostile to people who want to improve their lives, but the Mexican elite don't give a tired rat's derriere about their poor people. So they collect little in taxes, have a substandard educational system, have poor health care for the masses, don't promote job creation programs, much less regional development. And I think the Mexicans should be doing more to, say, pull up their socks with regard to their poor and not export them or hope they can solve the problem by exporting them to the United States, because you see the economic problems in California, which have certainly been sharpened and exacerbated by the number of legal and illegal immigrants who've come from not just Mexico, but from all over the world.
Well, just in closing, George Grayson, as the earlier PAN president, Vicente Fox, was ridiculed because he promised 10 million jobs. And the joke was, yes, he promised 10 million jobs, but they're all in the United States. And there's no question that Mexico exports its poor to the United States, but there's also no question that agribusiness and others here in the United States, restaurants, etc., take advantage of these low wages. So what kind of deal can be made? Because it has to be done on both sides.
I couldn't agree with you more. And the elite in this country, the United States, is really out of touch with the masses. The masses, and this is whether you're talking about African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, or Anglo-Americans, they want to see immigration laws enforced and, if anything, tightened. But your big shots in Washington in the Republican Party want to appeal to the growers, the ranchers, the hotel chains, the restaurant chains, and so forth. And the Democrats, and I'm sure there are some people with humanitarian spirits motivating their action, but the Democrats want more brown people in the United States because they're more likely, once they get citizenship, to vote Democratic. And so this is a classic example of where the elite and the masses in the United States have totally different views, and they're like two ships crossing in the night.
Well, George Grayson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with George Grayson, who's a professor of comparative politics at the College of William and Mary. He's written more than 20 books, including The North American Free Trade Agreement, Regional Community, and The New World Order, Oil and Mexican Foreign Policy, Mexican Messiah, Andres Manuel López Obrador, and his latest book is The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, and Criminal Entrepreneurs. He's also an associate scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and answer some of your questions of late. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.